Half an hour later, as he undogged and opened the hatch at the top of the conning tower, Corwin had a fairly good idea what to expect. He'd seen underground dockyards before, even had one of his own, after a fashion, though he'd never actually used the part of New Avalon's disused service tunnel network that bordered on Lake Daniels for that purpose. Not being a collector of ships, since they tended to be even more unwieldy than tanks, aircraft, and giant robots, he'd never particularly needed to. He was not prepared for the sheer scale of the place, though. He'd been expecting a handful of slips, half a dozen at most. This room, well, from where I-401 was docking, he could only see about a half dozen. That was as far as the illumination from the few working lights in the high ceiling could reach. Something in the acoustics, though, or the air pressure in the space, gave him the inescapable sensation that there was a lot more of it that he couldn't see. While he considered that, two rows of lights came to life on the angled wall leading down to the docking slip on I-401's port side, flashing in time with the pulse of a warning buzzer. From somewhere in the indeterminate darkness up above, a massive inclined elevator platform descended slowly toward them. As it drew nearer, Corwin, Iona, and Shioi could see that Tenryu was docked upon it, her dripping hull resting on huge articulated dry dock blocks. A moment later, with a decisive mechanical thud, the platform came to rest, fitting neatly into the berth. For a few seconds, Corwin and the two mental models stood regarding the ship. This close, there was something oddly sinister about the violet glow of her bridge windows and the curious, tribal tattoo-like markings on her hull. The obvious lack of any human personnel probably added to the sense of otherworldly menace, too. Corwin could understand why the 21st century sailors who experienced humankind's first contacts with these mechanisms had found them so unnerving. There was just something weird about something that looked like it ought to be an inanimate machine acting for itself, an uncanny quality that more obviously self-animate devices, robots and the like, lacked. Presently, that quality was further enhanced as the ship spoke, in the same voice they'd heard over the hyperwave. Huh. So that's a mental model? Interesting. Doesn't look that hard to do. Let me see here. The ship's glowing bridge windows brightened for an instant, as if someone had fired off a photographic flash inside. Shortly thereafter, a door at the base of the bridge tower opened, and a young woman emerged onto the deck. Given the color scheme of the ship, Corwin wasn't terribly surprised to see that the newly minted mental model had gone with a similar look for her clothes. He was a little surprised at the style she'd gone with. Apart from the fact that everything but her white shirt was dark purple, she looked like an English public schoolgirl, cardigan and all, but with a slightly street-tough edge imparted by artfully disordered short hair, fingerless gloves, and what appeared to be a mechanized eye patch covering her left eye. The cruiser's mental model looked down at herself for a moment, turning her hands over and back again, took a deep breath, let it out, then said, "Well, this is interesting." Then, without further ado, she mounted the safety rail at the edge of the deck, springing effortlessly from there to I-401's flying bridge. Shioi made a startled noise and drew back, but Iona didn't move, and Corwin was too bemused by the whole development to do more than take a quarter step back. "Hmm," she said. "Human. Wasn't expecting that." Crouched in a predatory sort of way on the bridge rail, the mental model considered Corwin with one golden eye. He wondered abstractly whether the glowing bit on her eye patch represented some equivalent of a cyber eye. Why go to the trouble of including something like that when her right eye was, technically speaking, just as artificial? He wasn't entirely sure what function the mechanical bat ears hovering on either side of her head served, come to that. Then, grinning, she hopped down, reached behind her, and drew a large, vaguely Falchion-like sword from nowhere in particular. It, too, was purple, its surface gleaming in the overhead lights. "The name's Tenryu," she said. And then, with a decorative flourish, she leveled the point of her sword at his throat and asked with a low chuckle, "You scared?" Corwin's response was to regard her impassively for a moment, then... Well, Tenryu could never say for certain afterward exactly what he did then, only that it took about a second and ended with her flat on her back, her sword clanging to a halt against I-401's bridge rail up forward, and one metal-capped end of a 6-foot wooden staff nudging up under her chin, as its holder gazed down at her with the ice-blue eyes of a man who does not have time for this shit. "Not really," he said, his tone of voice more conversational than confrontational. Iona, watching all this unfold, wondered idly how long it would take Tenryu to think of employing her ship body's weapons, either for purposes of counter-intimidation, or, in the worst-case scenario, for an actual counter-attack. Newly made mental models tended to forget about that sort of thing. Shioi's own example was the most recent evidence of that. They all stayed that way for no more than a couple of seconds, Corwin looking down at the mental model he'd just trounced with an expression that was uncompromising but not hostile. Tenryu staring up at him with a look that was equal parts surprise and something impossible for Iona's limited interpersonal experience to read. The two submarines looking on, one impassive, the other nervous. Off to starboard, another alert buzzer sounded, but instead of a second elevator platform descending from above, the other neighboring docking slip flooded, just as the one I-401 was now in must have done, and the door at the back opened. A few seconds later, a third, smaller vessel arrived, the sleek gray shape of a United States Balao-class fleet submarine, her hull chased with fog dazzle markings of an extremely subtle yellow. Still surfacing as she came into view, the sub glided smoothly forward, and, without missing a single beat, rammed the key at the end of the docking berth, her sharp destroyer prow smashing concrete and bending the steel safety railing as if the structure were made of styrofoam and pipe cleaners. By the time she came to a halt, she'd embedded her bow a good 10 feet in the pier, upending a stack of barrels and crates to scatter with a great splintering, booming clamor. Corwin and Tenryu blinked at each other in shared bemusement, then turned their heads as one to look. "Ah, god dang it," the submarine cried in a woman's amplified voice. "Sorry. Sorry, everyone. I don't get out much. I forget how long I am." With a great scraping screech, she backed off the damaged key, pulling a shower of concrete chunks into the water, and then stopped more or less where she ought to have halted in the first place. Her bow, made of sturdier stuff than any real World War II submarine's hull, was completely undamaged. "Well," said Corwin, dismissing Stick. "That's rather broken the mood, hasn't it?" He reached down and offered his hand. After a moment's hesitation, Tenryu took it and let him haul her to her feet. She dusted down her cardigan and miniskirt, thanking him absently, then went to the starboard rail and leaned down for a better look at the new arrival. "Ahoy! Who goes there?" she called. "Tenryu, is that you?" the sub replied. "It's me, Lionfish." "Lionfish? What the heck are you doing way over here? Last I heard, you were still in Honolulu." "I followed I-401, Lionfish replied. A moment later, her conning tower hatch opened and out climbed a cheery-looking woman in an outfit reminiscent of a sailor's uniform, circa the same apparent vintage as the sub. If sailors of the same apparent vintage of the sub had tended to be buxom blondes, with a habit of tying their shirt-tails together under their bosoms and dispensing with most of the legs of their dungarees, anyway. So yeah, someone want to explain to me why I got woken up out of a perfectly good dream about me and Admiral Lockwood because of an unexpected unit activation? She asked. Then, looking more closely, she added, and why there are two of you, both of whom ID is I-401? And what's with the human? Tenryu explained what little of that she actually knew while she, Corwin, and the two submarines descended to the jetty. Then, as Lionfish's mental model met them on the quayside, the cruiser asked, "So what do you think of this human body thing? Pretty wild, huh?" The blonde grinned. "I know, right? I've had mine since the war, and I still can't get over all this stuff I can do with it." Tenryu gave her a startled look. "Since the war," she said. "I only made mine a few minutes ago, after I saw 401s over here. Where'd you get the idea?" "There was a comm flash went around about it right before most of the big ships left the planet. You must already have been in standby mode by then if you don't remember it." "Maybe. I don't remember much of anything. I've been shut down for so long," Tenryu admitted, rubbing thoughtfully at the back of her head. "Anyway, nice to meet you all," said the blonde. "I'm the USS Lionfish, but you can call me Leon. That's the name I've been going by in Hawaii all this time." "Leon Poisson looks a lot more convincing on a driver's license," she added with a wink. "I hope you're better at driving a car than you are at driving yourself," Tenryu muttered. "You're mean," said Leon with a pout. "I told you it's because I don't take the rest of me out very often. People tend to notice a World War II fleet submarine. I mean, poor Bofin never leaves the pier, so it's not like I can pretend I'm her." Then, before anyone could pick up that thread, she looked at Corbin and said, "So you're human, right?" "More or less," Corwin replied, deciding that there were two or three hairs there that he didn't have the time or mental bandwidth to split right now. "And you two are?" Leon asked, turning first to Iona. "Long-range submarine I-401. Iona," she said, then added, just as she had to Shioi, "I am Captain Ravenhair's ship."
"I'm sort of also submarine I-401, the tanned mental model answered, a trifle awkwardly. "But you can call me Shioi."
Leon and Tenryu glanced at each other with matching raised eyebrows, then turned back to stare at Shioi, who fidgeted uncomfortably under their incredulous gazes. "Okay, this is above my tonnage rating," Tenryu said finally. "Come on, you. We're going to have to run this past the big ships." As she spoke, a data ring like Iona's appeared briefly around her head. When it winked out again, nothing happened for a moment, and then all the underground dockyard's lights came on at once, instantly revealing the true scope of the room. As Corwin had suspected, it was vast, probably the second biggest single room he'd ever been in, after the fighting floor of the New Avalon Battledrome, and that assumed one didn't count the Babylon 6 O'Neill cylinder as a room. He hadn't suspected what lay in the row of docking berths off to the left of the one Tenryu's ship body inhabited, though. He had, of course, seen starships that were far larger than even the largest of the ships before him now. Even one of the small Genom Star Destroyers would dwarf a World War II vintage aircraft carrier or battleship. He generally wasn't seeing starships at such close range, though, and even if they were small relative to other vessels he'd seen, they were still far larger than he himself was, so the spectacle was more than a little impressive all the same. "Well," he said. There were six of them that he could see. The carrier, the battleship, and four much smaller vessels, each all but identical to the other three. As Corwin watched, fog markings appeared on each hull, the ship's bridge windows brightening one by one, and he realized that they were waking from shutdown, or at least some sort of low-power state. Like transformers coming out of stasis lock, he mused.
"Yeah, sorry, it's kind of an emergency," said Tenryu suddenly, as if in answer to a question he hadn't heard. Nearby, Leon and Iona both looked thoughtfully attentive, while next to Corwin, Shioi looked puzzled.
"What, this?" Tenryu went on. "It's a kind of an interface unit, I guess you'd call it, for dealing with humans."
"It's called a mental model," Iona supplied.
"Lionfish says there was some kind of joint net memo about it, but I never got..."
"Yeah," Tenryu went on.
"Mm-hmm."
She shook her head.
"Nah, it's not hard at all. You should try it. It's kind of cool."
She tilted her head thoughtfully.
"Okay, sure. Right away."
Turning to Corwin, she said, "Yamato wants to see you. Let's go."
Corwin had read once that the interior of the original 1940s battleship Yamato was absurdly plush by the standards of the day, more like a luxury liner than a warship. He hadn't expected the inside of the Fleet of Fog version to be equivalent. After all, apart from Iona, no fog ship he knew of had ever permitted a human being on board. There was no reason to expect that one of their most powerful battleships would be equipped to accommodate humans, let alone coddle them in the way a liner would have. As such, as he followed Tenryu up the gangway and through a hatch into the enormous battleship's interior, he was semi-consciously expecting the same kind of blank austerity he'd found aboard Shioi before Iona had configured her with a copy of her own retrofitted human accommodations, and found instead something much more like what the anecdotes would have led him to expect of the original. There was wood paneling in here, and carpets. What possible use did a fog battleship have for carpets? The room Tenryu led them to was evidently some sort of flag officer's mess, if the vessel's interior layout were akin to that of the original. It was even more graciously appointed than the corridors leading to it, and featured a long dining table with upholstered chairs and a candelabrum, for pity's sake. There was a woman standing at the head of the table. She was very tall, in her moderately heeled metal boots, a good 3 or 4 inches taller than Corwin, who was not a short man, and possessed the sort of build that his Uncle Thor would have summarized as healthy. Her very long brown hair was pulled back into a high-set ponytail, apart from shaggy bangs and a pair of long sidelocks, not too unlike what Cora's hair would look like, it occurred to him, if she let it get about 4 feet long, and her matching eyes were quite large. She was dressed in an odd white jacket that had long sleeves, but left her shoulders bare, a pleated red miniskirt, and asymmetrical stockings, the left one thigh-high, the right a knee-sock, that gave her an oddly whimsical air. At her throat was a curious metallic collar arrangement, like the gorget of a suit of armor, decorated at the front with the golden chrysanthemum crest of the old Imperial Japanese Navy. "First of the Yamato-class battleships, Yamato," she said, with a gracious bow and an unexpectedly friendly smile. "Welcome aboard." Then, gesturing toward the table, she went on, "The others will be joining us shortly. For now, please make yourselves comfortable."
"I have to admit, that's not the look I would have expected from you, Yamato," said Tenryu wryly as she took a seat at the table.
"Oh, really?" Yamato replied, looking surprised. "Whereas you look just as I would have imagined you, Tenryu," she said with all evident sincerity. Before Tenryu could reply,
There was a minor commotion in the hallway, and then a group of figures burst into the room altogether. Four girls who looked like they were 12 or 13, all about the same height and generally resembling one another, their faces bright with curiosity. Two wore caps and two did not, but apart from that and their different length legwear, they all were dressed alike, in old-fashioned Sarafuku school uniforms of white and dark blue, with red neckerchiefs. "Is it true?" one of them, no hat, tousled shoulder-length auburn hair, confident expression, inquired of the room in general. "There's a human in here?" "That must be him there," said one of the hat-wearers, a solemn-faced girl with long, feathery silver hair, pointing. The other one without a cap, her brown hair drawn up into a folded ponytail, gave a nervous squeak at the sight of Corwin and hid behind the first one who'd spoken.
"Hawawa, he's looking at us, Nanodes."
"He doesn't look very dangerous," said the fourth, who bore a striking resemblance to the second speaker apart from the much darker blue-black color of her hair. "You four, control yourselves," said a calm, very slightly forceful voice from behind them as a fifth person entered the room. This one, like Yamato, had the appearance of a grown woman, albeit not so tall or flamboyant in aspect. She was dressed in a sort of abbreviated kudo costume, with short-sleeved gi and chest protector, and geta on her feet, but instead of a proper hakama she wore a similarly styled miniskirt over thigh-highs. Her uneven, medium-length dark hair, pulled up into a ponytail on the left side of her head rather than at the back, was the only element of whimsy about her appearance, and it struck Corwin as strangely at odds with the cool, almost Vulcan-like composure of her face. At her instruction, the four younger-looking girls arranged themselves, after a moment more's confusion, into a row, like schoolchildren called to assembly, and the woman in the archer's outfit said to them, "Now, introduce yourselves properly." The one with long black hair opened her mouth to speak, but before she had a chance, the girl who'd spoken first stepped forward again and declared, "I'm Ikazuchi, not Kaminari," she added with a grin. "Please make sure you remember that." The girl who'd been about to speak first shot Ikazuchi a momentary glare as she returned to line, then stepped up herself and said, "I'm the name ship of the Special Type 3 destroyers, Akatsuki." Then, drawing herself up with a slightly comical air of dignity, she went on, "I'll expect you to treat me like the first-class lady I am." The girl with long silver hair went next, in the same quiet, unruffled voice with which she'd pointed Corwin out to the others. She said simply, "Second of the Special Type 3 destroyers, Hibiki." Peeking out from behind Ikazuchi, the last, still looking a bit scared, said in a small, breathy voice,
I'm Inazuma. Pleased to meet you, Nanodes."
"We're Destroyer Division 6, said Akatsuki importantly. "Feel free to rely on us," Ikazuchi added with a wink. That left the archer, who looked Corwin calmly in the eye and said, "Fleet Aircraft Carrier Kaga, Main Force, 1st Carrier Division." Corwin glanced around, acutely conscious of all the eyes on him, then said, "Hi, I'm, Corwin Raven here. This is Iona and Shioi." "And they're both I-401, somehow," Leon put in, grinning. "I know, right? How crazy is that?"
"Oh, thank you, Leon," Tenryu grumbled sarcastically. "I wasn't gonna, you know, lead up to that part or anything."
"Well, this all sounds very interesting," said Yamato with a cheerful smile as the new arrivals seated themselves. "Certainly not the kind of thing that should be tackled on empty fuel bunkers.
Let's have something to eat, shall we?
Corwin added, "Why do they have food?" to the list of mysteries confronting him on this completely unexpected day. But given that he hadn't had anything to eat since dinner the evening before, he wasn't inclined to argue about it. Besides which, it wasn't just food, it was food of a standard that lived up to the promise of its surroundings. He had plowed his way through most of a substantial helping of curry and rice before it occurred to him that the desultory conversation around the table was not simply a product of the diner's diligent attention to the meal. Upon reflection, it suddenly became apparent to him that the fog mental models were all engrossed in a conference on a level he couldn't directly perceive. They weren't very good at concealing the subtler signs, though, probably because most of them hadn't been in their human forms for very long. They kept glancing at each other, making momentary eye contact and then looking away without speaking. The exceptions were Iona, whose natural impassivity made it hard to tell that anything was out of the ordinary for her, and Leon, whose much longer experience with her mental model meant that she could participate in whatever virtual discussion they were having and keep up a stream of cheery conversation with him at the same time. For all he knew, they were debating whether they ought to kill him, or some other equally dire order of business, but Corwin didn't think so. The vibe in the room wasn't like that, and just as they couldn't quite conceal their silent conversation, he doubted they'd be able to hide it if mayhem were on the table. More likely, they were trying to figure out just what to do next, in which case, well, that made all of them. In the meantime, he might as well have some conversation with his dinner, and Leon was the one feeling chatty, so he asked her, "So how'd you get caught up in this business?" "Oh, you know how it goes," she replied airily. "Extended deep cover assignment, haven't heard from the Big Seven in centuries, not a lot to do. Oahu's lovely when it's not being shot at. And I've got a nice sea cave I can stash most of me in when I'm not using it, which is most of the time nowadays. Oh, once in a while I'll head over to Kauai or Maui or the Big Island, hang with the tourists, pay my right and proper respects to Loa and Kea, but mostly I stay in Honolulu. As for what I'm doing here," she went on with a big grin, "same reason you had Earth Force on your tail. That's down to you making a big ol' noise a few miles off Pearl." "Well, sometimes that sort of thing's an occupational hazard in my line of work," Corwin admitted sheepishly, hand behind head. "What were you actually doing out there?" Leon wondered. "I was asleep, and then, pow, close proximity unit activation. I was like, what the hell? I know for a fact I'm the only fog ship in Hawaii. Time I got myself together and out to have a look, you'd already run off. I took the opportunity to snipe a couple of those robot subs, because I'm always up for killing those dang things, and then I had to hustle to catch up." Corwin was considering his answer. He wasn't sure how much of the story he ought to lay on them at once, though part of him was tempted to just tell them the whole story and see what they made of it, when a sense of intense scrutiny tickled his awareness. Making a one-moment-please gesture to her, he turned his head to see that one of the destroyers, Inazuma, if he recalled correctly, was regarding him across the table with a sort of fearful fascination. She realized a moment too late that he'd noticed her looking. Going bright red, she looked like she might try to hide behind Ikazuchi again, but as that would have required getting up from the table, she opted for trying to make herself as small as possible in her seat instead. Before he could say anything, Shioi spoke up for him, saying in a friendly way, "He's really very nice." "Really?" Inazuma asked shyly. "Really?" Shioi confirmed with an enthusiastic nod. "He saved me from the dark, and even though I don't know what I'm doing and just get in the way, he let me stay." "That middle part isn't true," Iona put in calmly. "You did well in both engagements today."
I am so confused, Tenryu observed, her eye refocusing on the world around her. Sorry, Corwin said, then sighed, pinching the bridge of his nose. I'm a little off my game today. You're still fatigued from this morning, said Yuna, just a trace of concern edging into her voice. You should get some more rest. He shook his head. Not yet. This is essentially a first contact here, and I'm blowing it. He looked around the table again, noting the expectant or nervous or, in one case, blankly impassive faces looking back at him. And then thought, well, what the hell? And upended the whole bag onto the table. The God of Mecha thing, how Iona had come to be with him, what he'd been trying to do instead of accidentally resurrecting the original I-401 in the body of a fog ship. All of it. The whole pack of crazy. When he finished, he repeated the look around the table again, expecting to see suspicion, disbelief, maybe even outright scorn. Instead, he saw curiosity, amazement, continued blank impassivity, and four looks of nearly identical rapt astonishment, neatly arranged in a row along the opposite side of the table. Wow, said Destroyer Division 6, their unison only broken by the addition of a quiet nanodes at the end by one of their number. It certainly sounds like you've had an eventful time of it, I-401. Iona, said Kaga calmly. It has been outside standard operational parameters, Iona agreed, nodding. Then, in the same frankly matter-of-fact tone, she added, But I don't mind. I can see where you wouldn't, Tenryu agreed, eyeing Corwin with a hard-to-read, speculative look. In a friendly, conversational sort of way, Yamato asked, Are you aware, Captain Ravenhair, that you are the first person of Earth descent to make contact with any ship of the fog? Corwin frowned. Not if Leon's been living in Hawaii since the 21st century, he pointed out. Don't be a goof. Nobody I know in Honolulu knows I'm a fog submarine, Leon said, rolling her eyes. Please. That would end well. Well, yeah, there's that, Corwin conceded. I told you I was off my game today. He considered admitting that Yamato's assertion still wasn't entirely the case, until it occurred to him that no, it was technically true. Although Toga Kiryu and, presumably, Akio Otori had spoken to Iona before him, neither of them was actually related to anyone from Earth. Besides, neither could really be said to have made meaningful contact with her. They'd just ordered her around like the machine they had considered her. Before he could form an answer aloud, Yamato smiled and went on, Yes, you needn't defer to your predecessor. Based on I-401's debriefing, it doesn't sound as if Captain Kiryu made any worthwhile effort in that regard. Corwin failed to suppress a bitter chuckle. No. He wasn't the worthwhile effort type. Yamato sat back in her chair, her expression pensive, then said, We have a lot to consider. This situation is completely outside anything we were ever programmed to deal with ourselves. In the meantime, you three are very welcome to stay, rest, and replenish yourselves, as you originally intended. In fact, Shioi jumped slightly in her seat, unsuccessfully suppressing a yelp, then looked around as if trying to see who had touched her, though it was obvious that no one had. What was that? I've authorized the dock to repair your battle damage, that's all, Yamato assured her with another friendly smile. It would have started as soon as you arrived, but the dockyard systems didn't recognize you as a friendly vessel. I'm sorry, she added, sounding sincerely regretful. I'd have corrected that sooner, but it slipped my mind in all the excitement. Oh, thank you, said Shioi. Oh, that feels nice, she added, reddening across the bridge of her nose. Tenryu leaned back in her chair with a grin, hands behind her head. Repair Doc Cherry, she said. Tenryu, said Yamato, sounding faintly scandalized. Not in front of the destroyers. Sorry, said Tenryu contritely. To her right, Ikazuchi snickered and nudged a blushing Inazuma with an elbow, while Akatsuki looked awkwardly away and Hibiki rolled her eyes very, very slightly. Now, according to my internal chronometer, it's nearly midnight. Captain Ravenhair, if you'd like to take your ship's advice and get some rest, please allow me to offer you the use of my flag quarters, said Yamato kindly. We can continue this discussion in the morning. Half an hour later, Corwin lay in the dark, letting his brain wind down toward another dose of much-needed sleep, when the gentle nudge of a requested lens contact touched his consciousness. Hey, he said, accepting the link. Hey, Utrina's mental voice replied. How'd it go? Are you back in New Avalon yet? Well, funny story, Corwin said, then gave her the short version. Wow, said Utrina after a few seconds' silent contemplation. I am so gonna tell your mom about this. She'll be super impressed. I'm sure she will, Corwin replied with a mental deadpan. Anyway, it's all quiet here for the moment. I'm in a ridiculously posh stateroom. I think it's the Admiral's quarters, or possibly the Emperor's. We're sort of boxed in on this island if those droid subs got a message back to Earthdome about the engagement, which we have to assume they did. But on the plus side, it's a very defensible position, and I've got plenty of backup. After a pause to reflect, he added wryly, Heck, there's a whole destroyer division sleeping at the foot of the bed. Uh-huh, said Utrina. Well, look, keep me posted, all right? You know I'm not crazy about the whole you-Earth thing right now. Wouldn't be my first choice either, I assure you. Anything new on your end? Nope, Utrina replied. All's quiet. No news from the Northern Air Temple yet, but then... She hesitated, then added glumly, I wouldn't really expect any so soon. I don't mean to rush you, but hurry back. I shall make haste with all due deliberation, he promised, then added much less flippantly, I love you. Love you too, Utrina said. See you soon. Be as safe as you can. Stay alive. That's always job one, he said. Then, with the link ended, he turned on his side with a sigh and went to sleep. He woke more than a little confused, but finally feeling at least a bit rested. Sitting up, he looked around the room, slowly piecing together the fragments of memory that popped up from the day before. Were there other people in here? Camped out on the floor with futons? Not there now. Did that actually happen? Are you feeling better? Corwin turned to see Iona sitting in a chair near the bed, regarding him curiously. I had the strangest dream, he replied, rubbing his face. I made contact with a remnant fog cell on Earth totally by accident. There was this really awkward dinner party, and then, His voice trailed off in puzzlement as the stateroom door opened and four small, sailor-suited figures spilled in, bringing with them a tray, a pitcher, several other items, and an abundance of high spirits. "Good morning, Commander," said Ikazuchi cheerfully, placing the tray athwart his lap. "With the compliments of Yamato's galley," Akatsuki declared grandly, removing the cover from what appeared, to Corwin's baffled eyes, to be pancakes and bacon. "This is orange juice," Hibiki explained, pouring a glass of the pitcher's contents and arranging it in the appropriate spot on the tray. "I'll just put your laundry over here, Nanodes," Inazuma put in, placing the bundle she was carrying on the bedside stand. "Then a destroyer squadron brought me breakfast, and none of that was a dream, was it?" said Corwin slowly. Iona shook her head. "No." "Ah." Corwin sat considering this for a moment, then shrugged, said, "Well, thanks," and started in on his pancakes. Slightly to his surprise, Destroyer Division 6 didn't leave after making their delivery. Instead, they gathered at a discreet remove on the great expanse of the king-size bed, sitting atop the covers as if on the floor, and chattered happily with him, Iona, and each other while he ate. It struck him as odd at first, but their good cheer and evident friendly goodwill were so pleasant that he didn't wonder too much about it. Even Inazuma seemed to have lost her fear of him, which was unexpected, since his revelations of late in the course of dinner had, if anything, increased it. But certainly welcome. "Well, this looks cozy," said a voice from the doorway, and Corwin looked up from the remains of his breakfast to see Tenryu leaning on the jamb, giving him that rapidly becoming familiar little grin. Then, angling a thumb back over her shoulder, she said, "Kaga wants to see you when you're through with breakfast, Captain." Corwin folded up his napkin and placed it on the tray. He went to move the tray aside, but Ikizuchi beat him to it, whisking it briskly, efficiently away. "Well then," he said, "give me a minute." Washed and dressed, Corwin followed Tenryu through the maze of Yamato's corridors, with Iona alongside and the destroyers trailing curiously behind. As they went, he glanced at Iona and saw from the set of her face that she had noticed the same little detail he had. Back in the bedroom, Tenryu's smile had lasted only as long as Destroyer Division 6 were looking at her. As soon as they had finished bidding her good morning and turned their attention back to him, her expression had changed instantly from a grin to a pensive, even slightly worried, frown. Something was up, and though there was a number of things it could be, Corwin had no idea which of them, if any, it actually was. Shioi and Leon met them at the quayside as they came across the docking bridge from Yamato, the former looking excited, the latter sort of privately amused. "Hey," said Leon cheerfully, "can we steal Iona for a little while? Yamato's got something she wants to discuss with her." Iona glanced a question at Corwin, who nodded. "Sure, go ahead. I'll go see what Kaga wants while you're at it." "Very well," she said, and the three submarines moved off down the quay in the direction of the berths where I-401 and Lionfish were docked. "I've never seen one of us look to a human for orders before," Tenryu noted as she led Corwin, and, he noticed with an inward smile, Destroyer Division 6, off in another direction, away from the docks. "It's a little weird, but it doesn't bother me as much as I might have expected," she added, coloring slightly, after a moment's hesitation. "Anyway," she went briskly on, "that's sort of related to what Kaga wants to see you about, I think." More and more lights came on as they delved deeper into the facility, revealing that the area beyond the docks was as machine-precise and clean in its construction, but differently equipped. Instead of ramped walls, docking berths, and other machinery, this area was dominated by a series of vast cylindrical tanks, each the size of a small tanker ship, arranged in neat ranks athwart the great expanse of the chamber. Corwin considered the vista in silence until they had nearly reached the far side. As they neared the end, he asked, "What's in all these tanks? You guys don't burn oil." "Nanomaterial," Tenryu replied. At Corwin's low whistle, she smirked slightly and said, "This used to be our main repair and restoration facility for the whole Pacific. Our full fleet on active operations got through a lot of this stuff." "And when the fog abandoned Earth, they left you seven here to... what?" Corwin mused aloud. "Guard it? Be on hand to reactivate it?" "We don't know," said Hibiki quietly. Inazuma nodded agreement. "None of us knows, Nanardes." "Above your clearance level?" Corwin wondered, but Tenryu shook her head. "None of us remembers anything about it," she said. "We compared notes last night. We can't remember why we were left here. Can't even remember being left here. The last thing I remember, the five of us were heading out of Repol on a routine patrol, and then..." She shrugged. "Nothing, until I came back online yesterday to answer Lionfish's priority call." She frowned. "You know, before I made this mental model, it never would have occurred to me to even wonder about that." She sighed, puffing out her bottom lip to blow her bangs out of her eye. "This humanity thing is weird, man." Corwin chuckled. "You're doing pretty well for having only been at it a day," he told her. "I've been doing it for 19 years now, and I'm still not entirely sure what I'm doing." By this time they had passed the tanks, and it took him a moment to realize that they'd walked out onto the platform of another giant inclined elevator, similar to the one Tenryu had descended into the underground dockyard on the day before. Kaga's mental model was waiting for them there, looking even more grim-faced than she had at dinner the previous night, an effect heightened by the spectacles she had donned for reasons that escaped him. "Captain Raven here," said the fleet carrier. "The situation is precarious, and time may be short, so I'll get straight to the point. There is something I wish you to see." Before he could reply, the elevator platform started to move, descending deeper into the complex. Lights set into the wall of the angled shaft clicked on as they passed, and by gauging the distance between them and keeping count, Corwin could keep a mental estimate of just how deep they were going. As they descended, Kaga turned to him and said, "Yamato and I have been conferring with Iona via the joint tactical network for the past several hours. Based on what she's told us, we've decided to take a calculated risk and tell you more about our situation here. You see..." She paused, as if giving the matter one last thinking through, then looked him in the eye and went on, "The knowledge of why we seven were left here at Midway is not the only piece of information we've lost. The Admiralty Code, the set of directives which guided all of our actions during what your people know as the Fog War, is no longer present in any of our memory stacks. We have no standing instructions at all. No orders." Corwin blinked for a moment at Kaga's blunt declaration, then nodded thoughtfully as his mind turned over the implications of her statement. "That's part of why you never came back online until now, then? Or left to see what became of the rest of the fleet? No order to do so?" "Partially," the carrier agreed. "Without directives from the Admiralty Code, we had no reason to reactivate until Lionfish's transmission roused Tenryu to deal with Earth Force's submarines. Before that matter arose, before any of us had mental models to consider the matter in greater detail, we had only to follow our last good instructions. Regardless, though, there were valid reasons to hold this installation." The massive elevator slowed, then stopped at the end of its track with a hiss of settling hydraulics, leaving them facing a large door that put Corwin in mind of the entrances to the submarine pens back up on the port level. Kaga turned to face the door, then raised a hand, turning her palm up and making a sweeping, open sesame gesture. The door responded, splitting down the middle and retracting in segments, revealing that the platform had come to rest at the top of still another inclined elevator track, leading down into an even deeper chamber. Spread out before them, displayed to advantage by the commanding view, was what Corwin took for a multi-ship dry dock. Each berth appeared large enough to accommodate even a ship of Yamato's size, with large, faintly luminous platforms at the center of each slip, and there had to be dozens of them, more than he could casually count. Corwin let out a long whistle, stepping to the edge of the platform so as to get the best look he could at the entire complex. This is impressive. You've got the space to refit an entire battle group here, or build one from scratch. Kaga walked to where she could stay in his peripheral vision, adjusting her glasses slightly before she spoke. Indeed. In fact, most of the fleet vessels operating in the Pacific launched from these graving docks. Wow. Corwin's imagination filled each of the docks with a different ship, picturing them growing out of the central blocks as the fog nanomaterial was introduced and shaped into a final form. As he had the thought, he noticed that three berths were in fact occupied, though at this distance he couldn't make out what ships were in them or at what stage of completion they might be. "So are you concerned about someone gaining access to the fleet's construction protocols?" he asked Kaga, still scanning the shipyard with his eyes as he spoke. "Are harvesting the nanomaterial for their own purposes? I can certainly see being worried about that." Kaga shook her head. "No. Or rather, those outcomes would be bad enough, but the worst-case scenario is even more grave." While Corwin pondered what she might mean by that, he noticed movement in the shipyard complex far below. One of the dock platforms had broken formation. With ponderous, stately grace, it glided to the central aisle, which was aligned with the elevator track, then came toward them and began to ascend. As it came nearer, the shape upon it resolved for Corwin, and he realized that it was an I-400-class submarine, its hull a distinctive shade of blue rather than the gray and red of the actual 1940s ships. A replacement for the fog version of I-401 that he had destroyed back in Dicho. With a heavy mechanical clunk that echoed in the cavernous chamber, the dock platform on which the submarine rested reached the top of the track, stopping flush with the one on which they stood. Massive clamps secured the two platforms together, and a new warning buzzer began to sound. "Stand clear," Kaga instructed, and the seven of them all withdrew to one side as mammoth mechanisms transferred the sub and its docking blocks from one elevator to the other. With that job done, the two platforms disengaged, and the first withdrew back down the track into the shipyard. With a wave of her hand, Kaga called into being a staircase of glowing force hexagons leading up the side of the submarine. "Let's go," she said, and led the way up to the foredeck without waiting for anyone's acknowledgement. Once they were all up there, Corwin looking intrigued, Tenryu puzzled, the four destroyers gazing around themselves in quiet wonder, Kaga opened the great circular hatch on the front of the cylindrical structure atop I-401's main hull, the presence of which was responsible for the boat's off-center conning tower. On the original World War II submarines, Corwin knew, this had been the watertight hangar for the three Ceyron attack aircraft the vessels had carried, the launch rail for which ran up the center line of the foredeck beside them. In this incarnation, it was unsurprisingly devoid of aircraft. The fog had never been known to employ them,
despite having counted numerous members who, like Kaga, had taken the shapes of historical aircraft carriers. According to Iona, her hangar had only been used once, while she was under Toga Kiryu's command. The Black Rose had used it to transport the strike force she had carried to the Battle of Fort Tonrock. Apart from that, it had been left empty, its volume serving as nothing more than a sort of auxiliary trim tank for maintaining the imitated vessel's proper buoyancy profile. This one was not empty. Not entirely. Neatly placed in the exact center of the floor was a rectangular object about 6 feet square by 3 feet high, with radiused corners and a smooth, featureless gray surface, its only marking a luminous fleet of fog sigil on the side facing the hatch. While Tenryu and the destroyers hung back, uncertain, Kaga gestured for Corwin to follow her to the box, then turned to him and said, "This is our worst-case scenario, Captain." With a soft hiss, the top of the box parted and slid open, revealing its contents, and suddenly the curious gravity of the occasion made perfect sense to Corwin. Below the lid of the box, suspended in some sort of shock-resistant gel, he saw a neatly arranged grid of small metallic spheres, each about the size of a baseball and studded with an equatorial ring of 7 smaller nodes, and each marked with the same sigil as the box in which they lay. "Oh, my," Corwin murmured. The 4 destroyers crowded around them, pressing close and craning to see into the container.
"Oh, wow," said Ikazuchi. "Amazing, Nanondes,"
Inazuma agreed.
"So many,"
Akatsuki breathed.
"Harasho,"
murmured Hibiki reverently. Corwin turned to Kaga.
"These are..."
Kaga nodded.
"Union cores, the essential component of every ship in the fleet of fog."
Turning back to regard the cores, Corwin did a quick mental calculation, estimating based on the size of the box. The layer he was looking at contained about 150 of the objects, and if they were spaced the same vertically as they were horizontally...
"There must be nearly 1,000 of them here," he said.
864, Kaga replied.
"Who are they?" Corwin wondered.
"No one," said Kaga. When he glanced at her in puzzlement, she elaborated, "Not yet, at any rate. These are uninitialized cores. They are functional, but blank. They have no consciousness, no identity, in this state. And that is what concerns Yamato and me." Corwin opened his mouth to reply, but at that moment the shipyard vault filled with the spine-chilling wail of a new and unfamiliar alarm.
"Ah, crap," said Tenryu, instinctively placing herself back to back with Corwin and drawing that sword from who knew where again.
"I'm going to go out on a limb," said Corwin, "and guess that means the situation just got worse."
"You guess correctly," Kaga replied, and the elevator platform began to climb back up to the dock level, taking the submarine and its occupants with it.